Hi, and welcome to Youth Unfiltered, a podcast from Connect Evergreen. Connect Evergreen is a coalition in the Vancouver, Washington area made up of students, parents, and community members working together to support youth and build connections in the community. I'm Shreya Gupta, and along with my fellow interns from Union, Heritage, and Mountain View High School, we'll be sharing conversations about the issues, challenges, and ideas shaping student life today. Everything from substance use to social stigmas. Whether you're local or just curious about what youth are thinking and doing here, thanks for listening. We're glad you're listening.
Throughout our conversations, there's been a consensus that the adults in positions of power aren't stepping up the way you need them to. How do we get that to change?
Are we talking about like celebrities? Or are we talking about like police officers?
It depends on who's viewed as a servant, who's not just a position of power, but also
influence.
Someone with influence. Because for some people, maybe a police officer wouldn't. For some people, maybe a coach would be. Mm-hmm. For some people, maybe it's an actual, you know, someone who's popular.
Okay, so I think, well, celebrities, some celebrities I know, they do, and then some they don't. So like Kai Cenat. Like he'll heavily preach on not smoking and stuff, even though he does it. He tells his youth not to. And then for police, I think it depends on the youth. But most youth, if a police officer tells you to stop, they usually stop.
But is that out of respect or
just because they have to? Or else,
yeah,
it's like fear.
Yeah,
right.
I've seen some they just don't stop. I've seen some people. But they don't respect the police enough, and they just, I didn't get in trouble for this. My friend, we were walking by, and he blew smoke in his face.
In the cop's face?
Yeah. I don't know how he didn't get in trouble.
No consequences?
No consequences.
At all?
At all.
Here or Cali?
In Portland.
Oh.
So here. Being realistic about it, I feel like a lot of people, they're like, I don't want to talk about it because it's just such a sensitive topic, but making it, since it's already normalized when you see it, why are you acting like it's a sensitive topic to talk about if it's happening everywhere? It's like the same thing with racism. Like, everybody acts like, oh, it's just a topic I don't want to touch because it's super sensitive, and like, some people might get offended, some people might get here, and here, some people might disagree. Well, you're going to have that with every single opinion and every single fact. Like, so there's going to be people who disagree. So actually having people stand up and being like, you know, this isn't good, and we need to fix it.
Well, for positions of power at school, I'd say teachers, of course. And the expectation, at least for me, is that they at least say something or do something. Because a lot of the time, I feel like they turned a blind eye. Like in my freshman English class, you know, the kids were drinking in class and stuff. That teacher, she would have had to been like nearly blind not to notice these guys coming in with their Gatorade bottles and eyes bloodshot and stuff. But she never said anything. I don't think she cared that much or thought it wasn't her business.
I think they always just like put it off as to, oh, it might be a home issue. Oh, they're just coping. Oh, it's just not my problem. But like, it is your problem. It's your students, right? I feel like counselors should also speak up, reach out more often. Maybe like mental check-ins, pull a kid in. I mean, like, every time you pull a kid in, you think they're getting in trouble.
Yeah.
So I feel like normalizing pulling a kid in just to chat with them, like.
Yeah, because, like, at a lot of the schools, counselors aren't seen as people you can talk to if you need help, if you feel unsupported, if you're lonely. The more people you go for scheduling or more, like, official school things you need to take care of, like switching a class or figuring out a credit issue, like, I know a ton of my friends, and even myself included, we don't see counselors as people we can talk to. We see them as more authority figures who we need to keep our distance from because we don't feel safe around them or we don't feel seen by them. And partially, it's not completely their fault. I mean, at least in our school, there's like 1,200 kids. Obviously, they are not going to be able to get to like a personal level every single kid. That'd be unrealistic. But I feel like having counselors like not just be like, so official or so direct, like, we're wanting to get their job over with. But, like, if they see a kid who's struggling or who needs help, like, not just putting their issue off or getting through it so they can get it over with, but, like, checking in with them like, on a personal level.
Just to add on to the, like, the counselor part, I feel like many kids are, like, just scared to reach out because, you know, there's always that fear of, like, oh, they're going to tell my parents. Oh, they're going to get higher authority involved. So that kind of, like, changes who you ask help from.
And sometimes also counselors, sometimes they don't help. Sometimes they make the situations worse because it's something that they have to do with the school.
As far as reporting?
Mm-hmm.
But I've had some counselors where they're super, super, like, amazing, and they actually helped out a lot.
Yeah.
But then there's some you just, people don't want to go to because they have a bad rep, and then they're also, they might like working with kids, but they might not be good at it.
Because counselors aren't like therapists. They're not bound for privacy, right?
Mm-mm.
Or,
not at all.
They're mandatory reporters. Yeah,
they're mandatory reporters. And
it's not like that, doesn't they can change.
It's part of their job. It's not their fault necessarily. Yeah. But that is an aspect of it that people consider.
That's an aspect why kids don't go.
So is everybody in the school system. Teachers are mandated reporters, principals, vice principals.
That's why kids don't reach out to them. Some don't.
Mm-hmm.
My teachers, they just say that you have to say hypothetically.
Yeah, so.
I guess that's a way to get around it.
Hypothetically. I teach it like that.
That's all my teachers have me do is say hypothetically this happened.
Sonia, that hotline that you're involved in, that you volunteer with, tell us a little bit more about that. Those calls are confidential, yes?
Yes, absolutely. That's the big thing that we emphasize. Unless you're suicidal or like you, it makes it seem like that you're going to like hurt yourself. We don't say anything. We don't talk to each other about like, we don't give out names. We don't talk to other people outside of volunteers about specific situations that we've encountered.
Okay. What about hurting other people? I thought it was like three big things.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, you're right. Hurting yourself.
Oh, what about other things? So I thought there was like hurting yourself, hurting other people. And the third one was, I forgot.
Yeah, you're right. So it's like, if you're thinking of killing yourself, if you're thinking of harming yourself or harming others.
Oh,
you're right. That's the trifecta.
Do you feel like it's an effective program?
I think, especially because it's over the phone and over text, it helps with that sense of anonymity. With the callers and stuff, they feel like a physical distance too. That helps a lot. And also the fact that it's teens answering the phone kind of helps with that reassurance.
How impactful do you think that particular program would be if it were available to more teens?
Definitely.
I think it'd be helpful.
I think people are more likely to open up to their peers than counselors or some teachers, depending on the teacher. But also I've known some situations where friends do confide in, like, it's happened to me, some friends confide in you about, like, how they're thinking of committing suicide, how they've been harming themselves. And while you want to tell, you know, you should tell somebody, you should get them help, there's that other sense of, I'm not tattling, but I'm telling something they don't want told.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of betraying their trust.
Yeah, that's it. You're betraying their trust because they trusted you that information. They don't want you to tell their people. But at the same time, you know, you have to do something. And then some kids like that are put into really tough situations.
Yeah.
To either betraying the trust of their friend or possibly them losing their life. And some friends, I know some people, like, they kind of act like therapists. Like, they have people who unload everything onto them. Mm-hmm. They unload their family issues, their friend issues, their substance issues, everything, like their depression, their anxiety, everything goes onto that one person. And that person will start struggling.
Yeah.
So it just becomes more of a chain then.
And then you get trauma bonds too. And then you get people who are just, they keep on going to that one person. And like, it's good to have someone who's there for you.
Yeah.
But then if you keep on getting worse and worse and worse, that's when you should start to seek out professional help. Like, once you start self-harming yourself, which a lot... Even though the people on our surveys are like, oh, I don't self-harm myself. Why would you answer yes on a school survey that says, do you harm yourself or think about it? You know what I mean? Like, it's so common.
So overall, are the school surveys useful? I mean,
it's so high.
Yeah. Even though it's anonymous, like, no kid is going to, like, there's always that, like, fear or that, like, why would I answer truthfully to this?
Mm-hmm. Even though it's anonymous.
Yeah.
Because it's still from the school. It feels like a cop asking you, oh, did you smoke today? Like, it's like, you just don't trust it enough. And then also, why would you just randomly tell them, oh, yeah, I've been thinking about harming myself. I've been thinking about harming others. I've been thinking about killing myself. Like, why? It just doesn't make sense.
Like, why would I tell them? Because, one, I don't trust them. Or why would I tell them? Because, two, I don't think they can help me.
Both.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just don't care.
Mostly the first one, though, yeah.
Okay.
What's the difference going to be? And then second, if a school is asking you, oh, are you going to harm yourself? And you know that the rule is, oh, if you're harming themselves, then they have to tell somebody. They have to get you help. Why are you going to tell them?
Yeah.
Because it might make things worse for you. Meeting with my counselor once a week to talk about stuff and I can't even fully talk about everything doesn't help. Mm-hmm. But I think if you go to like Sunnyside Hospital, if you go, you go and get actual help from a therapist or like some of these school psychiatrists where they have HIPAA laws in place where you aren't allowed to talk about it outside of there. But when they're like, oh, well, why don't you come talk to one of our counselors? Counselor doesn't have that type of training. There's some teachers that I think have better training than some counselors. A lot of the time, people just need someone to talk to. A lot of the time, people just need someone where they can come to you, tell everything that's happening, just have someone who can listen. They don't need advice. They don't need to know, you need to do this. They already know what they need to do.
Right. Like, they already just, know. Like, takes that burden off of you because then you can you have someone else to share what you've been through. So.
Like, no judgment. My bad. Okay. No judgment, no nothing. Just, like, sitting there and listening and be like, yeah, I can see how that, like, just straight empathy and being like, yeah, I can see why you might feel that way. I can see why it feels like that. I can see what's happening.
I mean, like, validation.
I was just going to add on that saying things out loud sometimes also helps you to get your thoughts in order and stuff and actually see the full picture clearly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a helpful aspect.
Validation is big.
Well, first thing, I don't think that validating their reasons for doing like substance misuse is a good approach because there's always a better option, you know. Okay. So I don't think that's one thing that you should validate because, well, it's just not the right path that they could have chosen, you know. Yes, it's not the path that they're at, but you got to diverge them from that path.
Okay. Yeah,
not necessarily. Not necessarily validating the behavior that they're engaging in because it's harmful. Mm-hmm. But it is good to acknowledge like the root causes of why they need to cope in the first place. Okay. Acknowledging that they probably went through a hard situation or there's some other reason. I think that's important. It's important to make the distinction that you're acknowledging the reason behind their substance use, not the behavior itself.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree with that. And also, like you said earlier, like we tend to overthink our own actions and our own behaviors way more than, you know, like the spotlight effect. Like you think everyone's paying attention to you, paying attention to your things that you do wrong, but rather no one's like, a lot of times people don't even notice. So people often start overthinking. They start being like, oh, I could have done this differently. Oh, why I do this? Same thing with like trauma or like traumatic experiences. Like they'll be like, oh, well, this was my fault. Like, what if this happened because of me? And that loop starts happening, like that loop of like that down spiral of just like negative thoughts, negative feelings that lead to substance use. But just having someone, like another perspective from the outside to look at the situation without like your own like negative thoughts like influencing it, having them listen to that and be like, no, it wasn't your fault. No, like what you did didn't cause that. I think that can be so, like so impactful to somebody. To say, oh, that was not your fault that this happened.
So someone mentioned it earlier, and maybe about just being able to unpack, just listening, not necessarily, like you said, looking for a solution, but just the ability to unpack. And like you mentioned, when you say things out loud, it also gives you an additional opportunity to reprocess that experience. I am really intrigued in this concept of having youth peers with the right training, with those circles of trust, because for the most part, you guys do trust each other in the way that everyone keeps. If you're friends, you're really friends, and sometimes it happens, but you trust each other with your secrets. There are people that you go to. Your community, your homies, it's like, all right, I know I can tell this person something. They're not going to tell anyone. But there's still that apprehension to tell them certain things because you don't know how helpful it's going to be to have that conversation. Being able to have youth counselors that have the training that also can keep your secrets and some HIPAA laws in place sounds like an ideal situation. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How did we get there?
It'll be a long trip, I'm not gonna lie, because there's so much stuff that you have to do to get that in place. Like, think how long it took just to get therapists, and then to get therapists to be known to be helpful, and then to get therapists to be known to be helpful to kids, and then having therapists finally in some schools. Because think, for the longest time, we only started developing psychology in like the late 50s to 80s, and then we started making it like known in like the 80s to 2000s. And now that we're doing it now, we're just now starting to be like, okay, kids need help too. So then if we want teens, I think teens are always going to be going through something. But if we make specialized teens in schools who have to deal with everybody's issues, like, it's a good idea, but then you got to think about the long-term part. Because if I come to Alia and you meet with, let's say, six to eight kids per day, that's 5 days a week.
Let's say,
as a teen, let's say you have one period and you also work at lunchtime. That's two to three kids a day.
Yeah.
And you have to deal with that 5 days a week. If you're lucky, maybe two, let's say two. That's six kids that you're consistently dealing with their issues. You have new kids coming up to you and having those issues come up. Then where does she go when she needs help? Mm-hmm. Plus, what does she do when she doesn't have the skills? Because she's... How much schooling would you get from that? Because therapists and psychologists, they need all this.
I get you're
learning DBT skills, but like, if you just have basic DBT skills, what's going to happen when you have someone who's way, way deeper with something that you never learned how to deal with?
Yeah. And also, like, for the more technical side of it, you need funding, you need to get the program established and approved, and you need to get it spread out. Like, it's going to take a while if that's something people are serious about. And then also, even if there are teen counselors, which I think a lot of youth will find more comforting than talking to counselors, there's still going to be distrust. There's still going to be, like, because it's different when you're talking to your friends than talking to, even though they're the same age as you, talking to a counselor or a teen counselor. Like, it's different than telling your friends.
Do you have that connection? Because
it's
like, I just met you. Would I just come up to you and tell you all my issues?
Right.
I barely even know these people. I wouldn't come up to them and tell my issues.
But the combination of a teen counselor with a therapist, then we had that HIPAA situation in place.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Where, okay, the therapist is there to monitor and can provide some guidance, but that teen counselor is the one, you know, really having the conversation, and when necessary, therapists can, you know, say this. So how does that work with the calls necessarily? If maybe you or someone else on the call, whoever's handling the call, hits a particular wall where they don't know how to navigate.
What we do often, especially if you're in person, either way, the supervisor will be listening in on the call the entire time. And then if there's something that is concerning or you don't know how to address, you either like shoot them a text or something.
Okay.
Or if you're in person, you just give them a little like gesture, like help me out here. And with the texts and stuff, oftentimes it'll be like a group discussion. If there's something that you yourself don't know how to handle, you can ask the other volunteers or supervisors to brainstorm together. So that's kind of helpful with the group environment.
And for the training the kids thing, that's also like, you got to think about the budget too. Like, you got to train all these kids and then they're all going to eventually graduate too, right? So then you got a whole new batch.
Yeah.
And you don't know how dedicated each kid is. So like, what if they drop out after the next year, you know?
Yeah. Like you said, as far as there needs to be a system in place.
Yeah.
Both of you mentioned budgeting.
Because we already have limited funds as it is.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying.
Exactly.
Just saying. Yeah. You can't turn on the AC in the gym. Who knows what they're going to do with a new program. Not that I salty or anything.
No, you don't sound salty at all.
No.
You're totally fine to be out of the gym for 3 hours.
In 91 degree weather. Yeah. No, sir. I'm getting off track. Yeah. But just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah.
I could also see, though, if you do that, and then, like, I can see drama starting from that, because then you're, like, you're talking to your friends, the person who's a therapist, and then they're talking to their friends, and they hear this, and they're like, oh, okay, but don't tell anyone that I heard this.
But they shouldn't be hearing anything, right? Because if there's a therapist,
But think teens, even if teens are like, oh, I'm not going to say anything, but then, like, I might hear a secret from Alia, And then I tell my trusted friend, Sonia, mm-hmm. and I'm like, Sonia, like, you can't tell anyone this, but I trust you so much, so don't tell anyone, but this is what's happening here. And then Sonia has a friend who's like that, and Sonia tells Alia that, like, oh my goodness, like, I heard this. I think if it's going to be like that too, I think it should be like, you don't start freshman, like, sophomore year. Like, you take classes freshman, sophomore,
yeah,
junior
I
year.
Agree with that.
And then finally you can start doing it your senior year.
I think you probably need to start doing it junior year.
Maybe, yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. There has to be, like, a lot of screening as well. And, like, mm-hmm. you can't just accept everybody. You have to look into how they act around their friends. You have to look how they perform during school. Not
like
perform,
if they're,
but
if they're getting
how they act during class.
I like screening.
Yeah, that's...
Because it's a really sensitive, this is a really sensitive job with really sensitive topics. You can't just get someone like who signed up mm-hmm. for college apps or something.
I can imagine adults hearing something like this and being like, absolutely not. They don't know what they're talking about.
Just them.
That sounds dangerous.
Yeah.
That sounds dangerous.
Good thing
this.
They don't get paid for thinking.
what would be your pitch? How would you try to convince them?
I mean, just bring up how counselors, like adult counselors, like.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Like how a lot of kids at school don't trust the adult counselors because they don't connect with them in that level. But then you have their peers who they like see in a different light, or how they can talk to them in a different way, like more casually. They can act more casually and they might be able to relate more, or they might, because they're that age, they're in that generation, they're experiencing the same problems like technology, with substance abuse, they're experiencing the same things alongside them. So having that, like, that different sense of connectedness, whatever, you get what I'm saying, yeah? Yeah, that.
Okay.
I think if they're being like, oh my goodness, that would never work, and they're having that idea of a power ultimatum of a kid can't do that, a kid can't do that at the same level that an adult could, I say they're probably part of the problem if they're thinking that a child just can't do that, or if they're thinking of children as, oh, they're this dumb. Kind of like how we talked about how children are the future. Like, we're the future who's going to be adults soon. Why are we treating us like we're tiny kids and can't do anything? Why are we treating us like we're not going the same exact stuff you're going through?
If I had to pitch this, I would say that it's a more controlled and safe way to basically continue what students are already doing. They're already venting and talking to their friends and stuff.
Right.
But in this way, it doesn't put that pressure on the friend, like if they're in a hard situation. And also it makes it easier for professionals and like other resources to get involved in helping whoever it is. So I'd say that, yeah, it's the same type of peer-to-peer support, which is more relatable and often feels more safe. But it's in a more controlled way that makes it easier for people to get help.
Yeah, I agree. I like that. That was good. Yes.
I think that's a very, very good, that's a very, very good point.
Yeah.
A very, very good selling point, because you're, it's not like you're taking their point and flipping it on them, but it's just the reality.
Yeah.
You can't identify one aspect of peer pressure in that dynamic and ignore what you can do on the positive side of it.
Mm, yeah. I think it's like the legalization of weed and stuff like that too. Like before then, everybody was still able to get it. Everybody was able to find it, mm-hmm. but it was sketchy. You didn't know if it was laced or not. You didn't know if it was this. Some people were getting it for medical reasons. Mm-hmm. But then once we legal, because people were going to do it anyways, it's right. dangerous. And then we created a system that makes it safe. It's accessible. You know that it's clean. So if kids are already going to their friends and being like, oh, I have issues, I have this and the other, then it overwhelms all the kids. But if you have a safe way to do it, it looks 10 times better.
Just introducing some type of framework mm-hmm. to discussions that are already being had between students, between within their peer groups, and then adding an additional level of guidance through the training and the therapists to create that sense of security and trust, it sounds like a win.
Yeah, and like you said before, like, peer pressure exists. It always exists. It's always going to exist because of the, like, the influence that friends have on friends or teens have on other teens. Even so, we all know it exists. We all know it's happening in schools, and there's negative peer pressure. We're like their friends are pressuring you to try this, try drinking, try smoking. But why don't we use that same, like, not power, but use that same influence and do it for something positive, like make it something good. Like, it doesn't, like, peer pressure, like, there's negative peer pressure and there's positive peer pressure. Like, it doesn't always have to, like, you don't always have to feel that pressure in a negative way. You can also, like, for example, in, like, driver's ed, where you learned about positive peer pressure, like, how you can be like, oh, go under the speed limit, oh, put on your seatbelt, like, teens are more likely to listen to their friends, to listen to people their age. So just using that influence would be, like, really impactful.
You mentioned how you feel that substance use is normalized on college campuses. What are some of the ways that you've encountered that?
In college campuses? Go to a party. Not even just a party, but if you go, like, you're not supposed to smoke. They have people in the dorms where they're like, oh, you know, they walk by, they make sure no one's smoking. You got edibles. It's literally a part of the college experience. Like, they call it, oh, if you're not going to do it in high school, at least have your college experience. Smoke, drink, and like you said, when you were younger and you tried stuff out when you were in your 20s, it's like the time that you're supposed to. But when you think about it, the male brain isn't fully developed. The frontal lobe in the male brain isn't fully developed until you're around 25.
Right, and then all over social media, it's just like, oh, get ready with me to go to the club. Oh, get ready with me for a party. Friday night party. Tuesday night party. everyday party.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And you also see it in movies and TV shows of, like, college. Like, you know, like, movies where you see, like, college life. You see the actors, like, going out, like, partying, drinking, smoking, making it seem cool, making it seem like part of the culture of college, all part of the excitement of college, just to try these things, just to, like, you know, out of curiosity, experiment, and really, like, feel, I feel like it's also the sense of belongingness, or like, oh yeah, I'm doing this college thing right, I'm doing this the right way, I'm making sure this is enjoyable, I'm making sure this is memorable, and it's just so normalized in media, popular media, it's not even, like, concerning to a lot of people, it's just part of what you're supposed to do, like, it's a part of the checklist in college, you have to drink, you have to go try edibles, it's just something you do.
It starts in high school, though. Like, if you go to high school parties, it starts, and you start drinking, you start seeing it, and then you go to a college party, they already started drinking when they were in high school, so now they're doing, like, Tito's, and they're drinking Don Julio, they're drinking all this, and when you look at, like, college, like, most people think, oh, like, some people are going to think Harvard, some people are going to think Stanford and all these Ivy Leagues, and then some people are going to be like, oh, I'm getting turned in college, go to San Diego, and
But I don't know if that's what you were trying to say earlier, but I think some kids, like, target some schools or apply to some schools just for their party culture. Just, like
there's a top 10 party school list. Like,
that's what you were trying to say earlier.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. Like, number one and number three. So, number one is Santa Barbara, SoCal campus. So third or fourth is, like, San Diego. And some kids will apply to these schools. In Minnesota, they'd be in Minnesota and apply to it just for the parties. Yeah,
just like some kids apply to, like, I don't know, Stanford for their programs, like their academic programs. Some kids apply to these types of schools just for
their Arizona University.
ASU. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Some people just apply there just to go to the part.
Just break up with your spouse if they're going to ASU. Just break up.
I was going to say, to add on to that, it's actually pretty interesting. Some of the websites that, like, tell you information about different colleges, they'll actually, like, rank the party scene, or, like, just like they rank, like, Greek life. How big is that?
How do you know, Sonia?
How big is the party scene?
Yeah. I've seen that scrolling.
Sonia, do you want to tell us? We need to ask our research?
No.
Okay. Waiting until college?
Another thing, though, I know some people personally who, like, go to high school parties and try, like, edibles or start drinking in high school to prepare for college, just to prepare.
I've seen it. Like,
I know people who do that.
That's pretty silly reasoning.
Yeah, like, instead of studying, they're gonna go to this party and drink and start vaping, so they're not caught off guard or seen as, like, the newbie or freshie in college.
That's weird reasoning.
I know people who do that.
It's like how I was talking about for high school, like, how I first came and then we'd go to parties and stuff. And then you're all around it, and you're like, oh, okay. And they're like, oh, well, we do this at college parties all the time.
It's, again, that thing of belonging or being accepted. They don't want to seem like the newbie or the innocent one. They want to be, like, in the culture.
They want to be in, like, frat houses and stuff. If they, like, Bro, I would never ever be in a frat house. There's some that are good, but now it's just like there's a lot that are bad. Like a lot that are bad now that are doing stuff that isn't even like part of that culture anymore. But like it's like you said, it's their own culture. Like it's like they're getting ready to get turned, they're getting ready to do this and the other. And like my uncle, when he went to college, bro, he was out for like 3 weeks because he ate a whole thing of Rice Krispie, like Reed Rice Krispie brownie things.
Yeah.
Oh.
In preparing for today's conversation, we talked about some of the racial and social dynamics that shape stigmas around users. Let's hop into that.
Well, because like you look at people who have a lot of money in luxurious areas and they're drinking wine, they're drinking champagne, and they're like, oh, where they're just living lavishly and like they don't have any issues. They're not alcoholics. They're just having, like, they're just celebrating. They're having fun. And then you look in places where it's like less income and like different demographic than living up in the Beverly Hills or living up in an expensive household, and they're drinking Don Julio, they're drinking cheap beer, they're drinking stuff like that. And it's like, oh, they're ghetto, they're ratchet. Like, look at how they're partying when these people, they're both dancing, they're both celebrating the same way. They're just not spending $2,000 on a whole bottle of wine. Yeah. It's the same thing though. If I pull up to school and, you know, I have a fully thrifted fit and it's the same exact stuff as this dude who's wearing it right next to me, you can't even tell the difference. Okay. But he says, well, I bought this. I didn't get it from the thrift store. We're still wearing the same outfit.
Also, there's high functioning alcoholics, you know, even if they seem like their life is going great and stuff from the outside, they could still be struggling with the exact same problems with alcoholism as anybody else. So it is really hard to judge from appearances. And it's not quite accurate to make judgments based on what you know.
Yeah.
And an alcoholic's an alcoholic. Doesn't matter where they live, how much money they have, what house they live in. If you have a drinking problem, you have a drinking problem, it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic state is. That's what people tend to miss because they see the superficial stuff. They see the big house. They see the fancy cars. And they're like, oh, this person knows what they're doing. They're supposed to be successful. That could have come from anywhere. That could have come from your family. That doesn't attain to that person themselves. You have to know more about the person, like what they do and like who they are. So like just looking at like their house or like their like where they live, it doesn't say anything about them. It doesn't say that they're not alcoholic or that they're not like a druggie or something.
Is there an expectation that once you attain a certain status that you're supposed to be using?
Right.
$100 million and you spent, oh, you're retired and you got time to spend your money and you're A-class celebrity.
Why don't you have a bottle of champagne?
Yeah. I've seen so, dude. And then look at how many celebrities overdose and die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, really big one. His name's Kurt Cobain in the 90s. Like, you don't know him. I know you don't.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Also,
it's on recording, by the way.
Not to
dump too much conspiracy on it. There's some questions around this.
Yeah.
We're not going to get into that right now.
You know, full documentary worth the question.
We're not going to get into that right now, but like...
Point still stand. Either way.
Juice World. Oh, yeah,
no, sure. I mean, it happens.
Yeah.
But even, like you mentioned, with celebrities. So when it happens to celebrities, we know about it.
Mm-hmm.
When it happens to people who aren't celebrities, we don't know. But it's still happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's definitely still happening. But I would like to circle back to just what is kind of like understood the level of expectation when you have certain things. You know, when you have a level of opulence, when you have a level of wealth, it's like, yes, this is what we do on the weekends. This is the way we party.
Yeah.
We made the comparison yesterday to college. And we also see that kind of like also mirrored in media, movies, TV shows, online content. How does that play out for you guys?
I mean, like the college thing yesterday, as we were talking about, it's kind of in a checklist. Like, it's like something that people see that you should be doing, or everyone does this, I could do it as well, so that I can be on the same level as them, or I can belong, I can be accepted in this social group. And like you said, it's like everywhere on media. It's in movies, it's in TV shows. That's how it's portrayed. Like drinking champagne on the weekends to celebrate like a promotion. That's encouraged. That's like, you should be doing this. This is what you are supposed to do to celebrate.
Can you give me an example of how you see race play into it?
Everybody drinks different alcohol. There's different types of plants in different areas. Like, you're not going to find the same alcohol in South America that you're going to find in Ireland. So if someone's drinking champagne versus someone who's drinking Don Julio, and let's say that it's a cheap champagne, same types of costs.
So you're saying it's like stigmas around even the types of substances that people use. Mm-hmm.
People look at like cheap Corona drinks and be like, oh, like that's what Mexicans drink. And then be like, oh, well, that's a cheap beer. I'm not going to drink that. Or they'd be like, oh, I'm not going to drink Don Julio. Like, that's a ghetto drink. Like, that's what black people drink. And then be like, well, I'm not going to drink Coors Light. That's what ratchet right people drink.
And there's also, like, different expectations for each, like, racial group. Because you could see, like, I don't know, like, not to, like, stereotype or anything. You could, sure. You could see, like a group of white people, like, going, like, drinking beer and, like, they'll be like, oh, they're partying. Like, people are more likely to excuse that than when you see a group of Mexicans or Indians and they're drinking. They're like, oh, look at those thugs. Look at those. Like, why are they misbehaving? Or like, why are they like those alcoholics? There's like people have a tendency to assume more depending on how you look. Like a brown person, they could have one drink and people would see them as a raging alcoholic. Rather than a white person, they would have... They could be drinking, binge drinking, and that could be excused right. As more situational. Like, it's just situational versus, like, person, like, attribution, you know?
I think it's also through the person who's looking at it, like, if where you grew up from. Because, like, white people, they'll look down and they'll be like, oh, they're being loud and they're partying and look at how they're partying. They're literally watching, like, UFC in their garage drinking Coors Light. What's the difference between having a family cookout and drinking, you know, Hennessy or like stuff like that?
Right.
It's the same exact thing, but they're looking at it like, oh, they're partying different than us. Like, that's weird. And then they look at them like, what the fuck is they doing? Like, it's on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets more seen like on social media for black people.
Yeah. Situations that you can't relate to, like culturally or something that seems unfamiliar to you, it's very easy to... make those negative associations with the person as well, associating the behavior with negative judgments about that person.
I also have some personal experience with that. I have some, like, my stepmom's family, like, she's Mexican, and so, like, some of her family live down in El Paso, Texas. And I know, like, her father and a lot of her family, they refuse to go to healthcare. Like, they will not see doctors because of, like, the stereotypes and because of the aggression they have faced in the past or that they've heard their family faced in the past. That ties in with getting help. Because if those groups are faced with that aggression just for, like, healthcare, regular checkups, what aggression will they be faced with, like, that they think they'll be faced with when they're going for help with substance abuse and getting the help they need to, like, lead a healthier lifestyle? Like, they won't go to those people because they're already afraid.
Because so much of that is put on the person that is dealing with the abuse.
Yeah.
You know, it's there's this moral element that's thrown on top of this. Like, you're where you are because you're making poor decisions.
Yeah, and he like blew out his back because he did farm work down there. He blew out his back, couldn't walk, and he still refused to see a doctor just because he didn't trust them at all. Like, he can trust, like, the science, he can trust the medicine. He can't trust the doctors, though. The providers. Yeah, and he's afraid he's going to be stereotyped and stigmatized just for the way he looks or just because the career he has. Yeah, thanks.
I've seen it based on a system too, because if you look at, like, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, how doctors were treating different ethnic groups, and like with my aunties and my grandmas, they don't go to the doctors. Like, they just don't. just because they're looking and be like, well, look at the 50s. Like, I heard this story. I watched this story. Like, I've seen this happen to these people. Like racism and like slavery wasn't that long ago. And then even after we had it abolished, they were still getting treated. They're still getting treated differently. My grandma, she won't go to the doctor. She'll die in her chair before she goes to the doctor.
That's it for this episode of Youth Unfiltered. Thanks for listening. We are the Connect Evergreen interns working with this coalition in Vancouver, Washington, to bring you these conversations. Make sure to follow along with the future episodes, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.